insight into what these obstacles to concentration are, it might be helpful if we had a little bit better idea of what concentration is and what role it plays in the scheme of things here, insofar as the Buddha's Eightfold Path to the cessation of the unsatisfactory, the cessation of suffering. So as you can see from, you know, I've got the Dharma wheel up here again this evening, and this is sort of the Rosetta Stone of the Buddha's teaching on the end of suffering. Okay. Each of the spokes of the wheel representing one aspect of the Eightfold Path. Okay. And these eight aspects of the Eightfold Path are organized into three sets or three groups. One group goes by the Pali name Samadhi. The word Samadhi is variously translated as meditation, or also, to keep things from being too clear, as concentration. Okay. Taken as the meditative qualities, there are three, and those are concentration, mindfulness, and effort. And the three of them combined allow the mind to become steady and clear and capable of attending for long periods of time to what's going on in the mind. Once the mind becomes stable and is capable of mindfully examining the contents of mind, then those qualities get turned to an investigation of what's happening in the mind, literally, insofar as our views of ourselves and others, our views of how we came to be who we are, and how others come to be how they are. Okay. So, and then, of course, Don last week, you know, was giving this talk and hosting a discussion on this very question, which is to say, because once the mind becomes capable of having these kinds of insights, that teaching, Paticca Samuppada, you know, dependent origination, is based upon an insight the Buddha had into how the mind constructs the self, you know, the actual assembly line, how the mind goes about doing it. And then also, you know, when you're folding in all the ingredients for the creation of self, right? Especially if a lot of those ingredients are kind of long on mind states affected by, you know, by greed, hate, and delusion, then bingo, that's what accounts for the kind of karma that you've had up until this point in time and what kind of karma you may have going forward. And likewise, to the extent that your past activities have been influenced by mind states imbued with generosity and wisdom and kindness, then of course what you've begun to do is to change the mix, change your karmic mix. You know, you're acting more from beneficial motives, and you have more and more and more beneficial results for yourselves and others. Okay, so the samadhi factors of effort and concentration and mindfulness create favorable conditions in the mind, like, you know, working the soil in a garden, that make possible deeper and deeper insights into the nature of ourselves, the nature of our own karma, the nature of our society's karma, the globe's karma, karma of all sentient beings. The greater our insights there become, the greater insights become as well into our own motives and intentions, okay, which is to say, how are we going to speak or act or live our lives in the future? And these two, what are called the wisdom factors, are referred to collectively as panya. The third set is referred to by the Pali word sila, okay. Sometimes translated as morality, sometimes translated as ethics. The translation that I like best is from the scholar Bhikkhu Bodhi, who describes sila and its root meaning as living in harmony with, living in harmony with yourself, living in harmony with other people, living in harmony with all sentient beings. Okay. And so far, and the three aspects of sila are speech, actions, and livelihood or way of life, how one makes one's way in the world. They're configured as a wheel because they are all mutually reinforcing and mutually supportive. If you have a wheel in which you have some spokes that are very strong and others that are very weak or non-existent, you don't have a wheel for very long. Okay. In order to maintain the integrity and the structure of the evolution of your consciousness, you know, your maturation, your realization as a spiritual being, all of those aspects need to be in some kind of balanced relationship with each other so they can kind of mutually reinforce each other. So this evening we're going to be focusing, and for the next three or four times together as well, we're going to be focusing principally on those samadhi aspects, the meditative qualities, okay? Not to the exclusion of the others, but as a way of understanding how they kind of need to be in place in order for the insights to arise and the more beneficial behaviors to start originating themselves, okay? And tonight and going forward, I want to focus principally on two of these. One is samadhi, and the other is sati, mindfulness, okay? And their relationship with each other. How they mutually reinforce and strengthen each other. So it is indeed possible to have a fair amount of concentration and not much mindfulness. And it's indeed possible to have a certain amount of mindfulness and not much concentration. Ideally, when you are exerting right effort, which is the other aspect of the meditative qualities, these two develop in ways that strengthen and nourish each other and make the mind ever more pliable, ever more clear and bright and capable of seeing clearly what's going on. There is in the teachings of environmental science, ecology in particular, there is a concept called consociation. And what consociation refers to is two plant or animal species, in this particular example I'm thinking of, two plant species, the Palo Verde tree and the giant saguaro cactus in the Sonora Desert on the American Southwest, where I grew up. So Palo Verde tree is this very hardy tree with a smooth bark, this green, it's for the Spanish name Palo Verde, or green stick. It grows mostly around washes and places where there and hillsides in the Sonoran Desert where there's some water someplace in the nearby vicinity. When you see Palo Verde trees, quite often you'll see a small saguaro cactus growing in its shade. And the reason for that is that the saguaro cactus, they can grow to upwards of 100 feet tall, live for about 200 years, but they only grow about 10 feet or so for the first 50 years of their life. From the time they germinate until they reach a certain height, they need to be in the shade. If they're out there, they'll become desiccated if they're just totally out in the direct sun all the time. So that's why you usually see small saguaros growing around Palo Verde trees, because the ones that didn't come to seed in a place where there was some shade didn't make it. With a Palo Verde tree, its strategy for getting water is it sinks fairly deep roots and kind of goes out here and there. It needs to find water somewhere pretty soon in order for it to survive. Since it happens to often grow on nearby the banks of washes and whatnot, it's susceptible to erosion. The strategy the saguaro cactus uses, insofar as its root system, is completely different. Its roots are very shallow, they're near the surface, and they radiate out in all directions. Okay, they fan out in a concentric circle. And they grow out further and further the taller the cactus gets, because these things weigh tons, and the wind will blow them over and whatnot if they're really not well grounded. So in the process of sending out its root system, the saguaro cactus locks the soil in place, which helps protect the Palo Verde from erosion. It also maintains a higher level of soil moisture, okay, because of its root system being there, which also helps the Palo Verde insofar as its survival strategy is concerned. So these two species kind of help each other out. They help each other to mature and grow stronger. And just so is it with regard to samadhi and sati, with mindfulness and concentration. Again, referring to one of my favorite Pali scholars, Bhikkhu Bodhi, the meaning of the translation of the word samadhi, okay, again, once sometimes it's used to refer to the meditative factors, sometimes just this quality of concentration. As in so many other translations of words from the Pali Canon, not such a great one, okay? Because it tends to connote some sense of density, right, or extract, essence of, something attained by some effort to constrain, right, to compact. And in fact, pretty much the opposite of what the quality of mind is that's being talked about. So we had a whole talk once in a teacher training group I was in with Bhikkhu Bodhi where about translation of the word samadhi. And the most satisfactory kind of translation that, or understanding of this term that we came up with, or that he guided us through, was tranquil, focused, sustained attention. Okay. Tranquil, focused, sustained attention. The ability of the mind to abide, to rest in repose, in a calm state, and yet not be sleepy, to be very, very alert, very awake, okay, for long periods of time. Attending to whatever the object is of the concentration. So, whenever you hear me use the word concentration, please think tranquil, focused, sustained attention. Okay. You need those qualities of mind in order to be able to see what's going on in the mind. As the mind develops those qualities, okay, the mindfulness becomes that much more acute and that much more capable of seeing with greater and greater precision exactly what's going on in the mind, and therefore much more capable of beginning to open to insights that naturally arise when you're really looking at what's going on in the mind. Okay. However, so that's how samadhi in the small s, as concentration, can assist with the cultivation of mindfulness. How about the other way around? That's what the hindrances are about. That's what the teachings about the obstacles to concentration are about. Okay. So the little exercise, and I don't know what the nature of your experiences we'll talk about in a couple of minutes, but what the nature of that exercise was about, what the whole set of teachings about obstacles to concentration is all about, the hindrances, is the application of mindfulness to the study of the mind's inability to concentrate. Right. So this set of teachings on the hindrances, it's about the application of mindfulness to the study of the mind's inability to concentrate. Not to do battle, not to whip yourself up, smack yourself around for the mind's inability to concentrate, but simply to investigate why the mind is having trouble concentrating. Okay. seeing what's going on in there. Okay. Whenever strong hindrances arise, okay, and they can take many forms, okay, one of their functions is to prohibit the arising of insights. Their function is to prevent you from seeing something that the inquiring mind actually wants to see. Okay. So the reason that the hindrances, when they arise, are a venerable object of observation, you know, something to really be mindful about, is that the more deeply you can look into what the nature of a particular obstacle is, as it just through the very practice of investigating it, okay, it begins to weaken a little bit and dissolve. And as you study the nature of that particular hindrance and how it's behaving, okay, as it begins to weaken and dissolve, you can begin to see through it, okay. It becomes kind of like an apparition, okay. And you're able to see what's on the other side, what it is that it was trying to hide. So as you get more and more familiar with the hindrances and when and under what circumstances they arise and what form they take, how strong they are and that sort of thing, then you become much more adept at teaching yourself what it is that the mind, that aspect of mind doesn't want you to see. Capiche? Questions at this stage of the game? Okay.
You're awesome.
So anyone on the basis of our sitting this evening have any ideas about what the mind didn't want you to see? What you know, I'll start, okay. Frankly, nothing real powerful grabbed me by the neck and shook me around a lot. It was more kind of subtler stuff that is, for the most part, familiar territory. You know, I started out in, you know, pretty calm state of mind is watching the breathing and whatnot, and then I was kind of finding myself, you know, hoping everyone's finding this sitting to be beneficial, and I thinking a little bit about what I was going to say, and then thinking about this, you know, website development project that I've got going, and then I noticed the mind was doing that more and more, and a little bit kind of more obsessively, I guess, than it had been before, and I began to recognize a couple of pretty familiar states of mind that arise for me. And so one of them is a little bit of kind of restlessness, you know, a little anxiety. You know, I hope that this talk and this discussion this evening goes well and whatnot. So there's some of that going on. And then as soon as I note that, then what oftentimes follows is, and this wasn't powerful, but it was noticeable. I could give a name to it, you know. A little bit of self-aversion for having felt restless. So I had two of them going there, right? Kind of playing ping pong with each other in my head, until I noticed that that's what's going on, right? And as soon as I noticed that that was what was going on, it was like two bubbles having a sword fight and they popped each other. And I realized, insofar as the restlessness or the worry or whatever, you know, the Dharma takes pretty good care of itself. Somehow or another, we'll probably manage to have a decent discussion about, you know, about this set of teachings and whatnot. And that I can never think of a circumstance when that sort of self-negation has not been literally self-defeating, right? You know, doesn't serve any useful purpose at all. And so again, realizing that to be the case, poof, it's gone, right? So please, anyone else that, you know, has found themselves facing something inquiring in someone, please.
So tonight I had torpor. And I like the word torpor.
Yes.
It feels like this sort of heavy curtain has come down.
Yes.
And I'm awake, and I find myself in sort of almost dream states. It mm-hmm. feels very much like just before you fall asleep.
Yes.
And it's like I'm fighting through cotton candy to get out of there. And so I'll fight my way out, and then I'm off in another dream, and fight my way out, and off in another, and all of a sudden, my head went, and I obviously didn't fight my way out of that dream at all.
Yeah.
And suddenly woke up, and then it just completely dissipated. It was really lovely, and had about 10 minutes of almost calm, followed, but with a little bit of my most familiar hindrance, which is restlessness.
Mm-hmm.
And mine, I describe it as, are we there yet?
Yes.
And it yeah, is good. The five-year-old in the back of the car waiting for the bell to ring. Are we there yet? Or if I'm on a longer retreat, is enlightenment just around the corner? But are yeah. we there yet?
Yes.
Are we there yet is the best name I've ever been able to have for it. And so, but that was much quieter, and I can just sort of go, are we there yet? And it'll settle down.
Thank you. Absolutely. The mind's kind of innate tendency to self-judge.
Mm-hmm.
You know, whether it's about the attainment of a spiritual goal or anything else, you know, to varying degrees, it just seems to be part of the hardwiring. It's just in there. And the lure of it, the way it really becomes powerful and is capable longer term of preventing tranquil, focused, sustained attention is if you buy into it. You know, say, okay, well, this is where I am at this moment in time, experiencing restlessness. This is where I want to be. You know, deep samadhi, you know, edge of, you know, some absorptive state or a path moment or something like that. And so basically my meditation mostly consists of waiting for Godot. Gee, that sounds like fun, right? So essentially buying into the hindrance is a way to create dukkha for yourself. You know, it makes the experience of sitting unsatisfactory because you're feeling resistant to the fact that you're restless, right? Rather than simply noting, restlessness, right? That seems to be what's going on tonight. The ability to be with, and again, you know, the kind of the working definition of equanimity, which is, you know, deep samadhi, you know, this tranquil state of mind, is to be able to be with the unpleasant without aversion and the pleasant without attachment, you know. And so all of these mind states we tend to think of as unpleasant or difficult or afflictive, you know, whether it's anger or unrequited desire or dullness or anxiety and worry and restlessness or doubt, okay. We think of them as unpleasant or painful states of mind, okay, which naturally tends to arouse feelings of aversion to them. So step one in working with the hindrances is to first be able to label it, just see it for what it is, okay? And then after you've noted it, after you've seen it for what it is, to then note whether or not aversion to it arises. And whether you engage in self-judgment for having the hindrance in the first place, okay. And of course, that's another hindrance. It's anger, you know, anger at yourself for not being enlightened. Wow, what is that one? You know, I mean, stop and think about it for a minute. You know, basically, all it is evidence that that when it comes to spiritual awakening, okay, the discursive mind is clueless. You know. It just doesn't know what's going on at all. Okay. And the reason for that is that in this particular tradition, at any rate, spiritual maturation, realization, awakening involves the progressive dissolution of the discursive mind, of the discursive self, that by definition does not know what it means to be absent.
to be
absent.
Absent.
The discursive mind, as Jack Kornfield sometimes described it, is insistent upon being present for its own funeral.
Right.
You know? But it can't be. And since it can't be, it's not going to let itself die. It's going to go down swinging. And that's part of what these hindrances are all about. You know, they're an effective guard against being able to directly penetrate, to have insight into the nature of the selfless, or the nature of the deathless, as it's sometimes called. Because that which is never born can never die. And so the hindrances work to keep that from happening. They're very automatic. They crop up simply as a means of preventing you from having insight into the nature of selflessness. Okay. Once you know that that's what's going on, okay, then you can say, it's like, oh, all right, you know, it's a protective mechanism. It's an automatic, completely selfless, completely automatic protective mechanism. And it is, in fact, stimulated or triggered or brought forth by increasing mindfulness. Because you got you have the mindfulness and the concentration that are working together. Mind gets calmer and clearer. The sati, the ability to know, becomes greater. The capacity for insight begins to arise. Okay. And at that point, the hindrances kind of come in and short-circuit things. Okay. It's basically out of a sense of self-protection for the self. Okay. Remember the analogy that the Buddha once used for the self. You know, he likened it to an egg. Okay. Nothing inherently kind of evil or malicious about an egg. It's a transport vehicle, you know. It gets the chicken fetus to a certain point where it can mature and break out. And so does the constructed self, you know. There's this little glob that's, you know, this bunch of molecules that we call self, you know. And it's got things, aspects to it we consider important, like color and gender and IQ and things of this nature. And then we ascribe other things to it, like a zip code and a social security number and a job title and, you know, all these things that kind of go to put this together, but it's basically just a big eggshell, right? And in order for freedom to actually occur, sooner or later this thing's got to fall apart. It's got to be recognized for what it is, you know, and just relaxed. And so being able to mindfully inquire into the nature of the hindrances and their arising, it's like the chick inside the egg pecking at the shell at the same time that the hen is incubating it. It's like you're working together to make possible this sense of liberation. Okay. So if you get if you see the hindrances as this malevolent array of forces that's going to keep you from ever achieving your goal, right, then that in and of itself can be quite discouraging, and that gives rise to yet another hindrance, which is doubt. You know, this is too hard. What am I doing here? You know, I think I'll go smoke some weed instead and see if I, you know, maybe that'll work. I'm happy for a little while anyway. So this is a different thing. It's understanding the nature of the process, understanding the nature, the need for patience, the need for persistence, the need for constancy. Just stay with it. You know, inquire into the nature of the, you know, what happens to the eggshell as it gets progressively thinner, you know. As the chick is consuming the nutriments in the shell and gets bigger, puts inner pressure, pushing the shell outward, it gets thinner, it gets more brittle, gets more susceptible to cracking and to opening, you know. And that's the same. That's the simile that the Buddha uses, similar process to the application of mindfulness to inquiry into the nature of the hindrances, is that it tends to weaken them a little bit, makes them more porous, and then you begin to see the possibility of some freedom occurring as a result. That's when they're, you know, and this happens when you're sitting for longer periods of time or sitting regularly, sometimes when you're sitting on retreat, okay. You have to really get familiar with them, really get to know them in a way in order to, number one, relax or weaken the aversive reaction to them. Okay. So they feel less like adversaries to be battled and more like interesting objects of spiritual study, you know, aspects of yourself that are worthy of inquiry, okay? Because although they're literally functioning in a self-protective way, the insight into non-self lies on the other side of understanding what the nature of the hindrance is. So we see that the first three of the hindrances, anger and desire and dullness, or sloth and torpor, are basically kind of moment-to-moment examples of what the Buddha called the three kalesas, or poisons or torments of the mind, greed, hate, and delusion. And that's getting closer and closer just to the core of the Buddha's teachings. When you speak and act, you know, and live a life that's imbued with feelings of greed, hatred, and delusion, you perpetuate your own suffering and you create suffering for others, you know. And then when you're doing just the opposite, you get the opposite result. Okay. So these are moment-to-moment expressions, flashes of anger or ill will, okay, or momentary expressions of that more generic or ambient mind state of aversion, okay, which in one extreme of which is hate, okay. A moment-to-moment feeling, or a strong feeling of ardent desire for anything, but usually something to do with sense gratification, is basically a moment-to-moment manifestation of this longer-term generic mind state of greed, of wanting, of attachment, of craving, okay? And then feelings of dullness, of flat affect, no energy, of kind of sinking into some kind of, you know, mental quicksand kind of sense of it, is a momentary expression of the state of delusion, of wanting to live in a state of not knowing. Okay. A state, literally a state of ignorance, a state of a desire to not know. Okay. So when you're sitting in that particular state comes to mind, you recognize clearly that you are in the state of sloth and torpor. Okay. What we're talking about right now, and this is kind of stage one of working with hindrances, which is simply recognizing them for what they are. Okay. And again, this is the practice of using mindfulness to study the mind's inability to concentrate. Okay. Stage one is simply recognizing them for what they are, seeing clearly what they are. Stage two, that we'll maybe talk about later on, is the practice of mindful inquiry into their nature. Okay. And so there are practices you can do, like if you're really being plagued by sloth and torpor, this dullness, you can spend an entire session doing mindful inquiry, asking yourself the question, what is it that the discursive mind does not want me to see? What is it that the mind wants to keep me from seeing? Okay. And then if you ask yourself that kind of question patiently, and then you just wait, an answer comes up. Kind of like a Ouija board or something, you know. Just some information will come up, you know. Kind of surprising sometimes, but you will get an answer, okay. Because your capability, you know, the capabilities of knowing this, you know, the ability to know, sati, and the ability to see clearly, to develop insight. You can use mindfulness to start developing insights into the nature of your hindrances. Before you start developing insights into the nature of existence and dependent origination and all the kind of more cosmic stuff, you can actually develop significant insights into the nature of your hindrances when they arise. Okay. You'll see that certain kinds of thoughts and feelings tend to be closely associated with each other and trigger each other sometimes. And it all comes just from exercising our mindfulness, our ability to be mindful, to the mind's inability to be concentrated at any given point in time. So let's talk about that dynamic some more. Anyone have any other questions or observations? Please.
So physical.
Yes.
Pain, you know, yes. Goings, all those, you know, intense sensations. So how does that kind of work as a hindrance?
Yes, of course. It's almost impossible not to feel aversive when that kind of thing happens. And that's in part because, you know, the hard wiring of the physical body, that's how we're designed. You know, if we're feeling pain, it's the body telling the mind, something ain't right here. You know, this is not good. We need to do something. We need to adjust ourselves. We need to do something so we don't hurt. You know, that's great. If we didn't have a nervous system that was capable of that, we'd be in a real fix, right? The pain as an object of inquiry is just really an interesting one, you know. When we have a bodily sensation, we judge it to be pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. If we have a bodily sensation that we judge to be unpleasant, it can trigger a lot of things. If we have a history of injury to some part of the body or other, or we know that there's some aspect of the musculoskeletal system or something else that's, you know, got problems, then we can recognize the pain perhaps as familiar. And simply recognizing this familiarity sometimes is, oh, that one again, you know, I'll move a little, just, you know, so I'm not quite so bothered by that. If we start, as we said, feeling pains and aches and things that we normally don't, okay, sometimes a minor adjustment in how you're sitting can take care of that. Other times, and this is where you can start then to become pretty sure that you're in some kind of state of restlessness. You know, like we ask people, for instance, in on retreat, you know, mostly they're held up in the mountains here and there, where we ask them, you know, please be sure to hydrate. You know, you can bring a water bottle into the sitting room. You can hydrate before and after a sitting, whatnot. But we generally ask people not to hydrate during a sit, just because it's noisy and distracting. Okay. And there are some people who've kind of may wind up doing it anyway, and in an interview, if they bring it up or if we bring it up, they'll say, I was absolutely certain when I was sitting that if I didn't have a drink of water at that point in time, my throat was going to swell shut and I was going to suffocate. You know, they were afraid that they were going to choke to death on their own mucus during the sitting if they didn't have a drink of water right then, right? Which is kind of, unless you have a, you know, a severe asthmatic condition or something like that. That was about 99% mental, you know. It was somebody who had an unpleasant bodily sensation, and all of a sudden it became a matter of life and death, you know. That they were going to die if they didn't get a drink of water. So being able to parse the physical sensation from, you know, the state of mind, you know, oftentimes it's a mix of the two. And being able to distinguish one from the other is important. Ajahn Amaro, a dear teacher of mine, once talked about the experience of pain when sitting. And he said, if you're sitting and trying to decide whether to move or not, this inquiry of yourself, would this be a genuine kindness to the body, you know? Or is it essentially a torment of mind that I'm experiencing? And if the latter, once really what can be a very skillful way to work with that is to not move, not adjust, but simply sit and experience the nature of the discomfort. You know, if it's a certain kind of pain, is it sharp, is it dull, is it steady, is it intermittent, is it rough, is it smooth, is it hot, is it cold, you know. There's some kind of identifying dimensions that people like Jon Kabat-Zinn use when they're helping people use mindfulness meditation to work with chronic pain, which is disaggregating it, you know, really getting microscopic about what the absolute nature of the pain is. Sometimes just the doing of that can cause it to dissolve or dissuade, okay? Because whenever you're doing that, what you've done is disaggregated the pain from the fear. Because automatically, whenever we feel pain, it's almost always associated with fear. Because a felt need to do something to keep, to make the pain stop. Is that way more, is that more or less on target, or is that?
Yeah, okay. And I think you stated the aversion to it, because that second arrow, right? You're feeling whatever discomfort, and then it's the aversion to it.
One way you'll know whether it's genuine body pain or what we call Vipassana pain is at the end of the sit when you get up to move around. If it dissipates, generally speaking, it was Vipassana pain. It was an unpleasant sensation around which you wove a story, you know, having to do with, you know, deterioration of the body and, you know, terrible things are going to happen in the future. A member of this Sangha was on retreat with us a few years ago, and during one of the interviews, she was saying, "I cannot get my mind off this black spot that I've got growing on my neck." She said, "It's been there for a long time. I've been thinking I really need to go and get it looked at, and I never have, and it looks to me as if it's getting bigger." And she spent a couple of 3 days absolutely obsessing about the spot on her neck and how certain she was that it was a metastasized melanoma. And so I said, "Well, you know, unless you feel the need to leave the retreat, there's not a lot you can do about it right now. You know, maybe cover it up from the sun, and then once you get back home, you can get some medical attention and find out what's going on." And so I saw her a few weeks later in the Sangha, and I said, "Did you ever find out more about that spot?" And she said, "Huh?" It's nothing. But it was something on the retreat. It was a very big deal. It was much out of mind. So, yeah. Thank you for the question. It's a good one. Please.
As we focus in on the hindrances, I find that there's a tendency to attribute agency to them, to essentially to make them more real than they really are. Which makes the battle comfortable rather than just thinking of it as a gateway, thinking of whatever the hindrance might be.
Do you have an example?
I would say that, probably the restlessness. Oh, there it is again. I'm perseverating. I'm thinking about doing, mm-hmm. Fixing things, and mm-hmm. getting this project done. As soon as I try to not focus in on there it is again, there I am again, and just watch it, then I think the dissolution is a lot easier. But as soon as I, you know, if I'm engaged in that conversation with myself, whatever, there you are, oh, there I am again, thinking about doing something.
Yeah, yeah. The hindrances are like five little novellas, you know, because basically they're all about the story of our relationship to that particular
right.
hindrance.
Yeah. Right.
Right. I think that's what you may be describing. Yeah. There's a phenomenon on retreat that's something called Vipassana romance. And the way that works, you know, you're on a retreat for 4 or 5 days, 10 days, 2 weeks, you know, 3 months, depending on where you're. And you're sitting in this retreat setting in a meditation hall where you're not speaking to each other at all, okay. Actually encouraged to likewise avoid eye contact, just so you can kind of go inside and be with yourself, you know. And yet there can be this phenomenon where kind of looking around and seeing who else is there, you find somebody for whatever reason you find very attractive and very intriguing. And you can spend a few sittings, you can spend a few days, you know, having these wonderful movies in your head about what it would be like to meet them. Well, maybe at the end of the retreat, you know, I'll go up and say hi, and we'll start a conversation. Turns out we have a lot in common, and we'll trade numbers, and then, you know, 6 months later in your imagination, you're engaged, and then, you know, and then come the kids, and then inevitably, the marriage counselor and the divorce. And then, all in your mind, right? And then poof, it's gone, you know. And it was nothing more than your relationship to your desires. That's the whole thing. It's called papancha, this proliferation, right? That comes out of your desire, you know, okay. Just like the noble battles that you fight when you're in a state of aversion, you know, and all the people that done you wrong and everything you're gonna do about it, you know. Mm-hmm. It's like that Tibetan saying, you know, all about us, the earth is hard and covered with sharp stones. We can seek to cover the entire earth with soft leather, or we can put soft leather on the soles of our feet, you know. All about us, our 10,000 enemies are arrayed. We can seek to defeat them all, or we can defeat the hate in our own heart. You know, it's just that, you know, it's developing this intimate relationship with that which you find troubling, you know. It gets in the way of the ability to concentrate. And then once we do, wow, things open up in an amazing way. Please.
I think maybe this is from lack of practice, but I find like restlessness is a really big one for me.
Yep.
And I kind of be aware of the first wave, like, oh, yeah. And then I get like, oh, I'm so goofy, mindful. And then my next thought is like, okay, why hasn't you gone away yet? Like you said, second wave of restlessness to like restless about the restlessness.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, that it doesn't dissipate, which I guess is maybe that I'm not staying long enough. But
no, I think what you're doing is a beautiful job of explaining the nature of expectation when it comes to spiritual practice. Okay. And, you know, And one reason it's really important to not fault ourselves for this is because the way we're taught to learn almost anything else in school or elsewhere, you know, here's the material that you need to master, and here are the metrics that we're going to use to measure how well you're doing, how well you're mastering it. This is how you should judge yourself. This is how I, as your teacher, am going to judge you in terms of whether, you know, in grade school you get your multiplication tables down, or you figure out, you know, sine and cosine, or whatever it is, the channel, you know, whatever the challenge is before you, there's an external set of metrics that's going to be used to evaluate your progress. And so since that's the way we've learned almost everything else in our lives, it's not surprising that we bring that kind of conditioning to bear on spiritual inquiry and spiritual practice, you know. And truth be told, all the Dharma systems have their own systems of spiritual scorekeeping. They do, you know, kind of a bummer, I think. But really, you know, these kind of ways of understanding kind of where you are in the scheme of things, right? Whether it's stages of enlightenment or, you know, there are a lot of them, and it would not serve us well to go into any of them now, I don't think. But they exist. So inevitably, there is this tendency to judge our experience. I think if all we can do under the circumstances is to remember that the judging, the evaluating, how am I doing, and if I find that the mind is restless again, that means I'm failing, you know. If all we can if as far as we can take it, is simply to recognize that that's a function of the discursive mind. That very thought is nothing more than a manifestation of the ego, of the constructed self. Okay. Then, bingo, not only have we become mindful of the arising and the functioning and the repeated arising of the restlessness, we've also gained a little bit of insight into its causes. Okay. It's just the self trying to reassert itself. Nothing more. Very automatic. And then, what oftentimes becomes possible, once that recognition arises, is a certain feeling of compassion, you know? Oh, self, I see, you know, you're going to go down swinging. It's all right, you know, we're not there yet, don't worry. I'm not at the fourth stage of enlightenment yet. You got nothing to worry about, you know. We're going to be in this for the long haul, you know. And then sometimes when you can convey that thought to yourself, it kind of chills out and says, oh, okay. Then you can go get caught up in desire or something, you know. Get on to the next one. Thank you. Appreciate it.
There's a bit of detective work, isn't there?
Oh, absolutely. You know, absolutely. This journal of this particular tradition over these last few decades, you know, the title's The Inquiring Mind. And that's exactly what's going on, you know. We're just training ourselves to inquire ever more deeply into the nature of mind, and into the nature of self and not self. Right. Like Dogen, to study Buddha Dharma is to study the self. To study the self is to forget the self. And to forget the self is to open to all things. Let's sit for just a minute. To study the Dharma is to study the self. To study the self is to forget the self. And to forget the self is to open to all things. Have a good week, everybody.